Boyle, individually et al. Versus Anderson, Yama A. Shansab, Appellant's Counsel, George O. Peterson, Cloyd Allen Smith, Appellee's Counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Yama Shansab. Good morning. I represent Sarah Boyle, successor trustee of the Strother Anderson Trust and individually. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to ask for 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you. Strother Anderson's trust agreement with Sarah Boyle, a successor trustee, qualifies as a contract or agreement under Virginia's Uniform Arbitration Act and the Federal Arbitration Act. The agreement, the contract, was between the successor trustee and the trustor. The agreement required the successor trustee to provide trust administration services, services which would be compensated, financial consideration. The offer was in the form of the trust agreement, and the acceptance was required to be made within 30 days from the trustor's death. The direct benefits estoppel doctrine binds Linda Anderson, claiming benefits of the trust, to the mandatory arbitration provisions in the trust.
But does that conditional donative transaction qualify as a contract for purposes of these two statutes?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe it does. The trust instruments, the donative aspect of a trust for its beneficiaries, and the 1874 Martz decision regarding will testimony or witness testimony in wills cases, do not undermine the agreement creating the fiduciary relationship between the trustor and the successor trustee. So the fact that there's a duality or a two-dimensional...
Is there a bilateral exchange of consideration? If I'm the beneficiary and I go, okay, I get $100,000, but I sign off on all the provisions of the... I can accept that, but how have I created a contract with the fiduciary? Isn't the fiduciary duty impressed upon the fiduciary by operation of law as opposed to consent?
It is consensual, Your Honor. The fiduciary duty is based upon the acceptance of the trusteeship. So although the time at which the consensual relationship is formed in this case was when Strother Anderson passed away, and in that sense it is unilateral, Your Honor, but the consensual act of accepting the trusteeship is bilateral, and that was the acceptance that was required by the instrument to have been made within 30 days of the trustor's death. The inter vivos trust, such as Strother Anderson's...
I'm sorry to interrupt. What is the trustee promising to the beneficiary? The beneficiary is making a promise, okay, give me the sack of money, I'll agree to the terms of whatever your document says. But what is the trustee saying to the beneficiary as opposed to the settlor, which has already happened?
Well, the agreement is... the contract or agreement is between the successor trustee and the trustor, or the settlor.
Got it.
The fiduciary duties are impressed upon the trustee to follow the instructions and terms and conditions of the trust agreement for the benefit of the beneficiaries. So that is an implied promise that I'm going to discharge the duties that are created by this document and the terms and conditions that are impressed upon me by the document.
I sort of get that vis-a-vis the settlor and the trustee.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what about the beneficiary, who's really just accepting a donative, the result of a donative instrument with conditions, that's all?
Yes, the beneficiary is accepting the donative conditions. That's true. And that's why we rely on the direct benefits estoppel doctrine to bind the beneficiary to the agreement between the successor trustee and the trustor. The beneficiary, of course, has to abide by whatever is in the trust document and has to take the benefits of the donative gift along with the perceived burdens in the form, in this case, of the arbitration provision.
One last question on this line. But does... the doctrine that says if you sign off on taking the money, you got to sign off on all the provisions. I mean, that's a given, right? But how does that make that acceptance of the condition a contract for purposes of the statute that only can be operable if there is a contract?
Well, again, Your Honor, that contract is between the successor trustee and the settlor and the successor trustee.
So there's horizontal privity there with a bilateral contract, but does that mean there's vertical privity, bilateral contract between the trustee and the beneficiary just because the trustee accepts conditions to the donative instrument?
Yes, that vertical privity exists by virtue of the beneficiary not disclaiming the interests under the trust. So the doctrines that we impose on the beneficiary, the direct benefits estoppel doctrine, for example, that is the doctrine that says, look, even though you didn't sign, you're not a signatory to the document, and that's consistent with the Hudspeth case that this court has ruled that can bind a non-signatory to a contract. That doctrine and others would bind. We also cited the Washington Securities case that talks about the third-party beneficiary doctrine. So those are the doctrines under state law principles that can bind a non-signatory to that agreement. And that is why, Your Honor, the inter vivos trust, such as Strother Anderson's trust, is best viewed as a contract or agreement creating a fiduciary relationship between a holder of property, the grantor, the settlor, or the trustor, and one or more trustees. Now, the Uniform Trust Code grants trustees the specific power to arbitrate. That's in Code Section 642778A23. It also recognizes a broad range of non-exhaustive factors that can lead to non-judicial settlement agreements. And it recognizes representation, even virtual representation, of a broad group of people, all consistent with alternative dispute resolution. Now, recognizing the inter vivos irrevocable trust as an agreement for purposes of the Virginia Uniform Arbitration Act or the Federal Arbitration Act, does not merge the law of contracts into the law of trusts. There is no sea change in either body of law.
Counsel, may I ask you this? I'm turning on my mic. Have we recognized direct benefits estoppel in Virginia?
Well, the Hudspeth case, the Bank of Hudspeth case, I believe it was written, authored by then-Chief Justice Lemons, or Justice Lemons, I think recognizes that these doctrines do exist, that state law principles exist. The Arthur Anderson case recognizes that state law principles exist. I don't believe under the Virginia Uniform Arbitration Act has this court ruled that the direct benefits estoppel doctrine applies. And that is why we have two assignments of error.
Help me with this doctrine. Where does that come from? Is that common law? Is it some newfangled doctrine that was judge-made?
It's unclear to me, Your Honor. Some of the decisions, if you read the International Paper case, talks about a federal common law. Some of the decisions talk about state principles, like the Arthur Anderson decision. So it's unclear whether it is a state common law principle or something that was adopted.
Because, as you know, by statute in Virginia, we default to the common law if there's nothing else out there.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that's binding. I mean, we're not at liberty to say, well, we don't like it, and so we're going to do something better.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the policymaking branch is the legislature, so if it's some court-created doctrine that other courts have recognized, there might be more reluctance for us to embrace it.
The case law, Your Honor, is very clear in one aspect, that it is a common law doctrine.
When you say common law doctrine, trusts were created by equity, by chancellors, not by common law jurists. Am I wrong?
Your Honor, I think that the...
In fact, that was actually one of the principal reasons for the chancellor to take this aspect of law away from the common law courts, is because they wanted to create a body of law that the common law did not otherwise recognize.
I believe it does go back to the division between equity and what we consider to be common law. Frederick Maitland, the English legal historian, says it's probably because the law of contracts had not yet developed as far as it
had. That's the whole point. It wasn't a common law doctrine at all, I don't think. I think it was entirely created by chancellors. But can I circle back, though, to this question of we're interpreting right now a statute, and the word is contract, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Should we use any interpretive canons? For example, if contract means this, that means someone loses their access to courts, which is a common law implied right, unless you willingly give it up. But shouldn't we strictly construe circumstances, at least under the Virginia Act, put aside the Federal Act, a whole different situation, strictly construe such things? In other words, cabinet until it's really clear?
Not in this context, Your Honor. Not in the context of arbitration. If it's unclear, then the court should expansively look at that definition and say, in arbitration, because we want to eliminate the resistance to arbitration, then we construe it broadly. And to the extent that we look at contract, a plain reading of the contract means an agreement between two or more persons that these persons agree to do or don't agree to do something. That certainly falls, that trust agreement here falls within that definition very squarely under plain language or plain meaning rule.
But when the beneficiary accepts under the doctrine you propose, what is the fiduciary agreeing to do? The fiduciary has already agreed to do the thing, which is use their fiduciary duties properly under the law to any beneficiaries that show up.
The fiduciary looks at the trust agreement and determines, can I follow the terms and conditions of this agreement as written?
I thought that had already happened when the trustee accepted the position of trust.
That is true, Your Honor.
But it doesn't happen every time a beneficiary comes on board and says, I'll accept whatever you got in the paper. I just want the money.
I'm sorry, I don't follow that question quite.
A bilateral contract, as I understand it, is I give something to you, you give something to me, consideration. The beneficiary says, I'll accept the money. The money comes down ultimately from the settlor, not from the trustee, and I agree to the conditions of the donative instrument. The fiduciary is not promising anything that the fiduciary hadn't already promised to the settlor. So this contract may theoretically be in the core of your argument, but the question is this a contract at all?
I think what the way to look at it is the way that the arbitration cases look at it, is that if the container agreement, the container contract may be between two persons, but if there's an arbitration provision inside the container contract that is one of the terms and conditions for receiving that gift, because after all, the interests that Your Honor is talking about are made available by the settlor through the prerogative of the settlor to impose these terms and conditions upon the gift.
You don't go to a common law judge on a breach of contract action if you're a beneficiary who gets hosed on the trustee not doing the right thing. You sue for fiduciary breach.
Well, Your Honor, that's right, but the fiduciary breach, the underlying agreement that gives rise to that fiduciary relationship is the agreement between the trustor and the successor trustee. And what we see in litigation, Your Honor, is a serious depletion in the trust's race and a permanent destruction of the family relationships. And that is avoided in arbitration. That's why Strother Anderson said, if you have a dispute over my trust agreement, you don't get to litigate it, because I don't want costly and lengthy litigation. If you have a dispute that cannot be resolved, Strother Anderson said, it must be arbitrated. We should honor that, and Sarah Boyle, a successor trustee, is duty bound to do so. I see that my time is dwindling. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 39
Thank
seconds.
You. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Cloyd Smith, and I work for the law firm of George Peterson, and I'm the counsel for the appellee, Linda Anderson, who's the administrator of the John Anderson Trust. Today, Sarah Boyle appeals a ruling that Chief Judge White, where he, using 150 years of Virginia precedents, ruled that the Strother R. Anderson Trust was not a contract and denied Mrs. Boyle's motion to compel arbitration. Mrs. Boyle, who was the named successor of the Strother R. Anderson Trust, who by the terms of the trust and Strother R. Anderson's intent was to divide that trust into three sub-trusts over a decade ago, now is asking the court to bind the beneficiaries to an arbitration clause by first asking the court to change the course of jurisprudence in Virginia for the last 150 years by calling donative instruments contracts.
Is this scenario different from an interim clause where the beneficiary sees, oh, darn, there's a clause in here that says I can't sue the trustee for anything or complain about stuff? That we say that binds the beneficiary. Why wouldn't we say in this instance, well, so does the ADR provision? I mean, actually, the interim clause is a whole lot more severe than the ADR provision.
Well, the Virginia Uniform Arbitration Act identifies this, identifies what should be arbitrated and what shouldn't be arbitrated, Justice Kelsey. And the based off of the Virginia Uniform Arbitration Act, I think, and this court has said over and over again, that when the language of the statute is unambiguous, we are bound by the plain language of the statute.
What about if the statute didn't require arbitration, but the language of the trust does? Why would you even have to go to look at the statute? Just like as Justice Kelsey was mentioning, we enforce interim clauses, why wouldn't we just enforce this based upon the language of the trust? You know, it doesn't matter what the Arbitration Act says. The trust says that you, in this particular instance, if you want money from this trust, you're going to have to go through arbitration to get it.
Well, Chief Justice Goodwin, I think what you're asking is you're basically putting the trust in the context of a contract in that case. If you're looking at the four corners of the trust, then you're treating it as a contract. And this court has, over and over again, pointed out why a trust is not a contract.
Well, the question, I think, would pose this inquiry. Suppose there were no federal or state arbitration act. The legislatures decided not to do it because they didn't think it was necessary. If people want to drop these things into trusts, they can, or wills, or anything else. Would it be enforceable under our law, even in the absence of statutory compulsion to enforce it?
If there was no law on it, Justice Kelsey, I believe that...
If there were no statute...
If there were no statutory law on this, I think we would fall back to the common law. And the common law says that, in this case, it's not a contract. But in this case, there is a law. And the Virginia legislature and the Assembly was very careful in how they worded that.
Well, suppose a trust is not a contract. Would we enforce an interim clause of a trust that just says, look, if you want to complain about the money I give you and you want to sue people, it's done. It's a condition subsequent. Your beneficiary status vaporizes and you got to get the money back. Forget the statutes. Would that be enforceable? I think Chief's question is going to that problem.
If there was not a statute, would we enforce the clause by itself? Because that's in the trust agreement. Are we saying there's no uniform trust code at that point too? Because I think we fall back to the uniform trust code. And for example, in Schoenberger in Arizona, that wasn't identified. Schoenberger, and if you look at Arizona's trust code, or the Arbitration Act, it's exactly almost verbatim of Virginia's.
Can I stop you for a second, just maybe because it might help? Why don't we start by just analyzing it in the way that I think the hypothetical was posed to you. There is no Arbitration Act, period. Poof, it's gone. Let's analyze the problem.
Looking at what I think it then falls back to what the court would like to do is follow the settler's intent. And in this, the settler had this, I think as in most people, they don't understand exactly what they have, but he didn't want this long, drawn-out litigation process. But if you're following the settler's intent, in this case, he wanted the money distributed to his heirs after his death over a decade ago.
Right, and if they had a dispute, he wanted it to be settled by arbitration.
And so the problem there lies in, you fall to Sarah Boyle saying that the appellant in this case saying we need to follow this. If the court were to rule that we need to do that, then you bring up the first breach doctrine. How does she enforce a contract that she, or if we're calling this agreement, how does she enforce this agreement
why
that she breached?
Why do you keep calling it an agreement when we're talking about just the administration of a trust? The Arbitration Act goes out of the window. We're just trying to administer a trust. Circuit court judge is sitting there, and somebody says, we've got a dispute in our trust agreement. The trust agreement says if there's a dispute, we have to go to arbitration. We have to do it or don't we?
And
there's no state law that talks about arbitration at all.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
That's okay.
I need to over-talk. It follows back to the fact of that you're not supporting a trust between Strother R. Anderson and Sarah Boyle, you're now binding beneficiaries that had no involvement or agreement to that trust, to something that they didn't agree upon.
Well, the agreement is the accepting the benefit of the trust with the conditions, which is a trust doctrine, not a contract doctrine. These questions are getting at whether or not your arguments are doing this, and the underlying first principle is what would we do if we didn't have in Virginia a alleged compulsion to enforce ADR?
If there was no other, there was no alleged compulsion to arbitration in this case, then the court would look towards trying to follow the settler's intent and following arbitration. However, that's not the case here. Chief Justice Kelsey, it's that the, or I'm sorry, not Chief Justice, Justice Kelsey, it's that there is an Arbitration Act and there is a Uniform Trust Code since 2005. And
but if the Arbitration Act doesn't compel it and we want to do it anyway, because our law generally says we enforce this sort of thing, the issue?
I think we look to what they did in Arizona, in Schoenberg. In Schoenberg, the court said, okay, we have this law, we have this Arbitration Act. It doesn't meet that. It doesn't. It's not an agreement about an existing controversy, and it's definitely not a contract.
I'll make this my last question, but the Arbitration Act doesn't say that you can't arbitrate when you want to, and it's not a contract. The Arbitration Act, both federal and state, is telling judges, look, if they say it flat out in a contract, you've got to do it, whether you want to do it or not. So the questions we're asking is, maybe our law does it anyway. We don't need to be told by a statute to do it.
Well, in this case, there is the law. There is a law that says what is binding in arbitration. There is an Arbitration Act, so the court is looking at the plain meaning of that. It either has to be a written agreement about an existing controversy or a contract. And this court has been clear that in order for it to be a contract, you have mutuality and you have a duty to arbitrate only if under a contractual obligation, and that a party cannot be compelled to submit to arbitration unless it has first agreed to arbitrate. In this case, if you were to call this thing, it was between Strother R. Anderson and the successor trustee, Ms. Boyle. It was not with beneficiaries in this case. They didn't agree to this arbitration. So you're not just enforcing upon Strother R. Anderson or Ms. Boyle. You're enforcing upon a third-party beneficiary that Martz was very clear about. Martz said when you looked at Duryllis Martz's will, 1874, If the only party to this is Duryllis Martz, not even the successor trustee in that case, according to Martz, according to the court, is a party. The only party to this is the testator or the settlor.
Fair enough. Thank you.
What about this idea of direct benefits estoppel that at least some courts have recognized? What role does that play?
Well, I think to get to direct benefits estoppel, Justice McCullough, I think you have to go over the hurdle that it's a contract. And in this case, it's not.
Does it? I mean, is that a contractual doctrine? I've seen plenty of contracts cases. I've never heard that invoked. Estoppel sounds like equity to me.
Well, if you focus on the equity in this case is that that Strother R. Anderson wanted the money divided between his heirs a decade ago.
But if you're right, I mean, the arbitrator's going to say that. So the only question is, what for? Arbitrator or a court? The arbitrator presumably isn't going to just say, oh, I don't care, I'll just do whatever I feel like.
So the danger to that logic is that you're going against what this court had stated in Mission Residential. And the danger is that a policy, although there is this favor of arbitration, policy does not impair the constitutional right of a party to have access to the courts, including the right to a jury trial if requested, unless that party has in a contract voluntarily waived those rights. So,
in a contract setting? But if it's
in any setting. Okay. So if you were to say now that Linda Anderson has to go to arbitration, you are taking away her constitutional right to go to the courts. And this court said you can't do that unless they waive that right. And in this case, Linda Anderson nor John Anderson nor any of the beneficiaries have waived that right.
Right, but there's a clear statement by the settlor about any number of things, including the argument you're making about distributing the assets. But one of those statements is, I want this, you know, this is a spectacle, it's expensive, et cetera, et cetera. I'd rather this go to arbitration. So we're supposed to honor every provision of the trust except the one that says arbitration.
Well, the problem is the reason we're here to this point of arbitration is not every provision in the trust has been honored. And because of that, Linda Anderson, John Anderson, and the other beneficiaries of the Strother R. Anderson Trust should have their day in court. And by accepting the fact that he intended to do this, then you're taking away their right to court.
But who's taken away their right to court? The settler. What about the settler who has an interim clause that says, you know what, you try to sue my trustee and you don't get a dime. What about them? What about their day in court? What happens to it?
And that's exactly why donative instruments are treated differently than contracts, because that settler is gone and passed.
That doesn't help.
Unless it doesn't help him, but it doesn't. Whether it goes to court or not, in this case, his intent hasn't been followed either, Chief Justice Goodwin.
Is the problem with this case that it's presented in the context of arbitration and contracts and whether trusts or contracts, when none of that should really matter? I think the questions that my colleagues are asking is, if we honor the settlor's intent, his intent was, if there is a dispute, it is arbitrated. Putting aside contracts and federal arbitration acts and Virginia arbitration acts and all of that, it's just a straight up trust question. What is the settlor's intent and should it be enforced?
I believe Justice Powell, I believe if there was not a law in this case, the court would enforce the settler's intent through the arbitration. However, in this case, we do have the Virginia Arbitration Act, so the court should fall back to that. I see my time has almost expired.
But before it does, let me throw you a bit of a lifeline. Your briefs acknowledge that prior to both of the arbitration acts, the federal and the state, there was extreme hostility in the judiciary to enforce in a contractual setting any sort of ADR for exactly the policy reason you mentioned earlier. So there obviously was a need for a compulsory statute to require it in common law contracts because common law judges were not enforcing it on public policy grounds. The question that all these concerns are implicating is that same concern in our precedent a problem in trust law? Because in trust law, we're generally not looking at public policy concerns involving contractual relationships. There would be no interim clause, for example, in a contract. It would be unreasonable and unenforceable as a matter of common law. But we allow it in a trust and in a will because of completely different policy judgments. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so, Justice Kelsey. And I would say that we're acknowledging that this is a problem, this arbitration, enforcing arbitration and trust clause. And to solve that problem, it's on the Virginia Assembly to solve that problem by signaling that there is this problem, an arbitration clause, and it's not right now solved in the Virginia Arbitration Act. They can do as they did in Arizona, and they can create, where it belongs in the Uniform Trust Code, a mandatory provision that allows for that arbitration clause. In Virginia, we have said for 150 years that donative instruments are not contracts. For these reasons, Linda Anderson would ask this court to affirm Chief Judge White's ruling, not change precedent, and not overturn Martz by calling this a donative instruments contracts or enforcing this under the Virginia Arbitration Act. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 39 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court's questions are grappling with the same problems that the court in the Bezazdegan versus Vernon case grappled with. That case in the Arkansas Court of Appeals said, look, the canon trust is not a contract in a traditional sense, but we want to do what the settler's intent tells us to do. And they ultimately decided, for purposes of our act, with the Uniform Trust Code encouraging arbitration, with the Uniform Trust Code empowering expressly by statute trustees to arbitrate, that court said, even if it's not a contract in a traditional sense, the arbitration provision is enforceable, and it's enforceable under Arbitration Act, because they viewed it as an agreement, not in the hair-splitting sense of contract and agreement that the Rochelle case looked at it, but they said, look, this is an agreement. In fact, in my brother's arguments, he used the term trust agreement so many times. It's hard to get away from the fact that this is an agreement. And if you look at the Estate of Campagna case from the Western District of Virginia, the estate of a deceased trust beneficiary was required to arbitrate claims against a financial advisor who had a contract and an arbitration agreement with a trust, with a trustee. That beneficiary never signed that agreement, but they used the direct benefits estoppel doctrine to say the contract between the trustee and that financial advisor and the arbitration provision in that document binds the estate of the deceased trust beneficiary who had never signed up onto that contract. Agree with you, Your Honors, that the settlor's intent ought to be followed here, and there has to be a way to find that within the parameters that are provided by the statutes in Virginia. And the Federal Arbitration Act cases recognize a broad range of agreements. The Metro East case recognizes that a tariff is an agreement. Now, by my lights, I thought a tariff was a tax, and that's how most of the taxes were collected in this country for many years. If a tariff is an agreement, this trust agreement is an agreement within the meaning of the FAA. I ask you to please reverse and to compel.
A question on the meaning of the FAA. The FAA talks about contracts, right?
It does, ma'am. Yes, yes,
and
Justice
so
Powell.
When you talk about agreements, you're bleeding more into the Texas law, where Texas specifically uses the term agreement, and that's the division that some of the other states have drawn the line between contracts that say contracts and those that say agreement, statutes that say contracts and agreements.
Your Honor, my time is up.
There may not have been a question there. That's okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please call the next case.